This podcast is presented by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, safer, healthier people.
Thank you for joining me for this edition of Health Marketing and Interactive Media. I'm your host, Erin Edgerton. Today I'm talking with Far John Marr, who is the founder of Envision Solutions. He has developed and implemented programs for global and domestic pharmaceutical companies, nonprofits, medical associations, and government organizations. He also holds a Master's of Arts degree from New York University. Welcome, Far. Let's begin with the definition of social media.
The terminology around social media, Web 2.0, new media, emerging media, it's really changing. So what I'd like people to remember about social media is that it involves technologies that enable people to collaborate and participate in global conversations around a range of topics.
When you're talking about social media for these types of collaborations, how is that affecting the way that public health professionals are interacting with their target audiences, both within the United States and internationally?
Well, I'm not aware of a lot of public health professionals who are utilizing social media. There are some evangelists out there who really focus on how and why public health professionals need to be using social media more broadly. What I can give in terms of specific examples is some of the public health work being done, of course, by the CDC, and I won't get into that too much because I think the audience will be well aware of the podcasts that CDC, including this one, is producing. CDC also has a blog, which is widely read. CDC, also with its new website, has done a really good thing, and I think it really gets to how people use health information in terms of seeking out information that their peers feel is important with the tagging and basically that's just a very simple diagram that shows people what the hot topics of the day are. That's what the CDC is doing. And when you think about public health in terms of focusing on the opportunities to receive information about health that will then influence behavior are the things I think public health professionals working through social marketing or health communications can do to really utilize social media in the most effective way.
Looking outside of public health, are there other industries that are using social media well?
One example, actually, that I would give is a wiki called the Flu Wiki, which some of you may be aware of, which was actually became the major source of information about bird flu when the mainstream media and even the CDC were kind of still gathering resources and getting information out there. And so a physician looked at that and said, well, from a public health perspective, people are very concerned about bird flu. How can we get information out there so that people can start to learn about it and become informed in a responsible way? So what ultimately happened with the Flu Wiki is that information was highly indexed by search engines. And so anyone, reporters, concerned parents, travelers, other folks, concerned about bird flu or wanting to get more information, went to that wiki. Another example is a social network that I refer to quite often called Sermo. And Sermo is a physician-only social network that has more than 10,000 physicians within the network. And basically what they are doing is they are sharing information on a global scale about treatment, about epidemiology, about side effects, about of medications, and a range of subjects that is starting to, I think, to shape how people treat disease. I think that, in the past, what we saw is that physicians were very isolated in terms of how they shared information. But now with the social network, they can start to get questions answered from their peers. Well, in my region, I practice this way. Well, what do you do here? And that starts to inform how people actually practice medicine. And it will start to get more people talking about the art of medicine and then potentially influence the science as studies start to come out to confirm some of the observations that people are making on Sermo. So those are two ways, I think, that people in public health can really look at social media as examples of things that are happening right now.
What impact are social media sites having on traditional authoritative sources for medicine and the way that people are understanding their health and the options that they have for healthcare?
Well, I'll preface that answer by citing a study that came out of the UK recently that actually looked at how people seek information online. And what they found is that people tend to ignore information from, or not necessarily ignore it, but maybe count it less, information from advertising because they distrust the point of view. But surprisingly, they tend to sometimes dismiss information from government websites. So the National Health Service website, which has a lot of great information on a range of subjects, is maybe discounted from by some users. However, when information was presented from their peers, with people who actually had the disease, they paid a lot more attention to that because they felt that that source was more authoritative than the received wisdom coming from the journals and the doctors and those kinds of things. And you know why? It's because what we tend to forget, I think, in general, but especially in health, is that it's all about me. My feelings, my problems, my situation, and everyone feels that, you know, well, my doctor tells me, but they don't really understand. So I think authoritative sources, we need to find ways to not only integrate some peer information to really contextualize the information that's coming from authoritative sources in order to make the information more valuable. And sometimes I might even be integrating some of the peer-related information into areas where people are finding authoritative information so that you have that back and forth. In terms of having content. And one social network that's actually trying to do this is a social network called Organized Wisdom, which is a social network for patients. And what they do is that they understand this dynamic, and they have created wisdom cards that can be created by peers and also created by authoritative sources, like, you know, if you consider a pharmaceutical company authoritative source, or the CDC, or a nonprofit. So side by side, you have both sources of information. And so all of a sudden, it's not, well, I go to one site and then I click to another site in order to get the full range. It's side by side, and that's a way that you can actually participate. So I think the way that people who create authoritative, or quote-unquote authoritative information can react to this is understanding this dynamic that I've just described and then finding ways to responsibly engage content creators and have your content where people are going for information.
Could you talk a little bit about the different types of social media that are available and the different levels of control that are offered by the different types of media?
You know, for an organization like the CDC, it would not be responsible for the CDC to cede control completely of messaging, of information, because it's viewed as one of the most authoritative sources around for a range of health topics. However, it can, organizations like CDC and other public health organizations can engage with social media by understanding what I call the continuum of control. And if you look at major types of social media, and some of these are blogs, which are websites that are easily updated by folks, they basically enable people to share information and have conversations on a global scale through a kind of one-way medium that then goes out and becomes part of the larger world. There are also video sharing websites. Everyone's heard of YouTube. People are posting videos on that website on a regular basis and sharing them with others. There are podcasts. I don't need to define that because folks are listening in on one and kind of can get what that is. And then there's also wikis, like Wikipedia, where people are creating documents and en masse. So if you think about the continuum of control, if you're interested in participating in social media and retaining some aspect of control, you can understand that video sharing websites and podcasts probably offer you the most amount of control if you want to participate in social media. The issue with podcasts is that many times they're one-way type of dialogues. There needs to be ways to actually get people to comment and participate and share the information. That's how it becomes more social. And the middle are blogs. You have some control over absolute control over what's posted on a blog, but unless you heavily moderate comments, you won't have control over what people say about that. And you also won't have control over how people refer to the information on your blog, because they'll link back to your information and talk about it in their own way. So blogs are kind of in the middle of the continuum. And then the types of technologies that provide the least amount of control are message boards, These are very old technologies where people are posting information online or on a range of topics. You don't have much control over that. You can post whatever you want, but when people get in and start using these, and also social networks, on a regular basis, they're going to have conversations about things that you may not want them to talk about, or you may, you know, have little expertise in. So you really don't have much control over that. But there's still a value in being involved. And then finally, you don't have a lot of control. Sometimes if you're looking at a social reality or a virtual reality like Second Life, you can set up your environment, but you can't really control who comes or, you know, what they do with that information once you're finished with it.
What about the digital divide, and how does that affect communications when we're looking to reach a very broad and diverse audience?
Before I answer your question in full, I'd like to define what the digital divide is. And we define the digital divide as the gap between minority populations, Southeast Asians, African Americans, Latinos, and the general population, if you define the general population as Caucasians, in terms of access to technologies. And usually we define access to technology as access to computers, and then subsequently access to the internet. The digital divide is real, but the digital divide is not as widespread as it once was. There was a study that came out from Pew, I think it was a couple of months ago, the Pew Internet American Life Project, focusing on the digital divide specifically. And, you know, people tend to think that African Americans, for example, don't have internet access or don't use the internet as much as the general population, if you define the general population as Caucasian. That's not true. Hispanics or Latinos tend to use the web less than African Americans and Caucasians. Asians use the internet quite significantly. So if you really look into the data, the digital divide is, there's still a divide, but it's narrowing. And the kind of misperceptions that people have about different ethnic populations and groups in terms of access is they're many times misplaced, especially when you focus on younger populations. Because younger populations are using these technologies much more so than maybe middle-aged or even, of course, the elderly. So it certainly exists, but it's less widespread than one would think. Now, that does not mean, though, that when you're developing a campaign that you don't keep in mind that some people don't have access to these technologies. So if you're thinking about social media technologies, one of the technologies that really is underutilized but can be used more is mobile technology. And Jay Bernhardt of CDC has focused a lot on mobile. And I think that it's certainly correct because the penetration of mobile technology, especially text messaging, is so much higher in some respects than that for internet access here in the United States. So if you're thinking about using mobile technology as a social medium to transmit information and encourage people to share, it's really underutilized in health and in other areas, and that's certainly something that we need to be thinking about as a means of overcoming or leapfrogging the digital divide.
With new social media sites appearing almost every day, how can public health professionals evaluate these sites and determine where they should spend their time and resources?
Well, what I would say is that if I were developing a campaign and thinking about the most well-established or the best types of media, social media to get involved in, I would focus on the older technologies like blogs and social networks and message boards and texting and those kinds of things. I would prefer those because more people are starting to use them. When you're evaluating different types of technologies, you really have to have a good understanding of what the user base is, if it's significant enough. And they need to be able to give you a sense of, you know, who's using it, how long are they spending on it, what are they getting out of it, those kinds of things. And again, there are new social networks being introduced all of the time. I would try to get that kind of information because that can tell you whether or not the effort is going to be worthwhile. So, and then in terms of just learning about social media and social networks, the best way to do it is just explore on your own. Just, you know, go to MySpace and find out what's happening there. Go to YouTube and find out what kinds of videos are being posted. I mean, there's nothing more educational and informative than having first-hand knowledge of what's happening. I understand that people don't have time to look at every single site, but at least have some familiarity with what's happening on these on the major sites and the major types of technologies to understand why people are using it and how they're doing so.
For ongoing campaigns in social media, how do you really start to evaluate the impact that they have on behavior outside of page views or click-throughs? How can you tell if your messages in social media are having an impact on real-world actions and decisions?
The first thing I think that should be done, and CDC emphasizes this, and it's in terms of when it's doing a social marketing campaign or a public any type of public health communications, that the importance of understanding your target audience before you go in, understanding what are the types of behaviors they're engaging in already, understanding what types of communications channels they actually use, really understand before you go in whether or not the intervention is going to result in people actually using the information. Let me give you an example. We know that Latinos or Hispanics use radio significantly, you know, much more so than other types of communications channels. We also know that they're not on the internet as much. So if you're looking to do a Spanish language type program, you have to understand that. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not effective to utilize social media, but you have to realize that maybe you might be getting folks who are more educated, who are more bilingual, who are more, you know, that's the group that you're going to be getting. And so if that's what you want to do, okay. You have a good rationale for going out and doing that. If you're looking to really get folks who are of a lower socioeconomic status, they may be recent immigrants and those kinds of things, putting together a social media campaign, not maybe the best thing to do. You might want to work with radio and newspapers and other forms of other communications channels. So the biggest thing, my biggest thing that I always talk to people about is don't get over-enthusiastic about social media because it's so new. And you get excited about the new. Now let's get to how do you measure behavior. I do still believe that it's hard to find out actually what people are doing unless you observe them. And doing observational studies of that kind are just way too expensive. So the least expensive way to do is to do a pre and post survey. Of a group that has not been exposed to the messages and then a group that has been exposed to the messages. And we see this happening all the time in public health. There was a campaign, I think, that was done in San Francisco focusing on safe sex for people who are homosexual in order to decrease the transmission of HIV/AIDS. And they did this campaign. It was a provocative campaign. It elicited a lot of emotions, but they did a pre-survey and looked at awareness, and they did a post-survey. And they saw that not only were people aware of the campaign, but they actually changed their behaviors because of it. So that there tells you that that's it's expensive to do that kind of thing. But if your budget can handle it, you know, I would say that's one way to do it. I also just want to talk about, you know, interim types of measures that you can use, because behavioral, the ultimate, you know, the outcomes are the ultimate goal. So you want to look at what kinds of information you're kind of having as outputs. But then there's use of, and if no one's picking it up or using it, that's an early indication that you have to change tack and have to change it. So to summarize my answer, the ways to measure a campaign is to use the tried and true measurement methodologies that people use all of the time. Do your research before you go into a program around social media. Understand who's going to use it and whether it's going to be effective based on the existing data. Then while you're involved in the campaign, you need to be measuring how people are using it and whether they're doing so. And if they're not, then you need to figure out ways to change course, and there are a variety of ways to do that. And then finally, if you really want to measure behavior, the best way to do that is to maybe do a post survey of a target audience to understand whether they're aware of the campaign, what impact it had, and then if they changed their attitudes and behaviors.
I'd like to express my appreciation to Fard for joining me for this edition of Health Marketing and Interactive Media. For more information about this podcast series, please visit the CDC's Health Marketing website at www.cdc.gov/healthmarketing. I'd also like to remind all of our listeners that the use of trade names or commercial sources during this podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement by the United States Department of Health and Human Services. Views expressed by guest participants are not necessarily the views of the CDC.
For the most accurate health information, visit www.cdc.gov or call 1-800-CDC-INFO 24/7.